To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 178, and I'm your host, Dallas, and with me today we have
Dawn Moore
and my daughter, Emily. She won't be saying much because she's only 7 months old, though. So, welcome, everyone, and welcome, Dawn. Welcome back to my place.
Nice. Good to be here.
Yeah. It's nice because Dawn and I haven't done an episode, just the two of us, for a while, and we've got a lot to talk about. So I think, sometimes, we go off on a lot of tangents depending on who's on the show, and I feel like this is kind of going to be a very comic book centric episode. And one of the main reasons is Dawn and I have been passing back and forth books for a little while, and I read quite a few books that Dawn recommended, and we've been wanting to talk about them for a long time, but we never had the opportunity until today. So now that it's just the two of us, we have two series that we really want to talk about. The first one is called Dalgoda, which is a Fantagraphics book that was released in the mid-80s.
Early 80s.
And then the second one we'll be talking about is a book called The Atomics by the amazing Mike Allred, who does Madman comics. So we'll get back to that later, but first off, before we start talking about our comics, how you been, Dom?
I've been good. Been busy, but good.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, we're pretty, actually really, really busy at the Widget Factory. Right, Emily? besides working 10 to 12 hour days every day, I think everything's been going well. It's always weird with that time change too, because it gets darker earlier in the day.
Yeah.
Ready now. I've got my peppermint mocha coffee. I'm like all in for the holidays. I'm ready to roll. So,
The time change never made sense to me. I know people argue, why do we even do it? But in the United States, they have daylight savings time, and it changes, well, November 1st, it's always kind of different.
I think so, yeah.
But you're supposed to put the clock back an hour in fall, and in spring you advance it an hour forward.
The spring one sucks because you lose an hour of sleep.
The fall one is kind of nice because you get an extra hour of sleep, but it, for some reason, throws us off. And what didn't make any sense to me is all of a sudden it gets dark early. Really early.
Yes. It's a combination of the changing time and also because of the seasons, because of how late it's getting in the year, the days are getting shorter anyway.
Yeah, it's in summer I really like it because, class lets out at 7:30. In summer, it's still bright. Class is over. It's still just bright. It's like in the afternoon. You can go home and talk to your neighbors and, the sun's up till about 9 o'clock.
Now the sun's down at like 6 o'clock at night. Yeah, it's like 5:45, 6 o'clock.
Well, and by the time December or January, it's going to be black before I even get to class at 6.
I always dreaded this time back when I worked in the office because it took me an hour and a half plus to get home every night. And this time of the year, I'd get home and it'd be dark outside.
So, hell yeah.
Going into work, it'd usually be dark outside too because I'd go in so early. So I'd never really be able to see the light much.
Well, for the holidays, my daughter's job added a third shift, and she's in charge of it.
Wow.
Which she was excited about, but she said, because it's a promotion, but she said, I don't get to see the sun anymore. And I said, yeah, that's an issue, isn't it? I've been there. There was times we're on overtime, and I never saw the sun.
That's right. I mean, I think just a couple of years before I started there, and I've been there for a decade, but a couple of years before I started there, you guys were on crazy overtime for months on end, right?
Yeah. And hopefully that's not going to happen again.
Gosh. You okay, Emmy? She might be interjecting a lot today, guys. Huh. I just want to tell you, she's got a lot to talk about. She's very excited about her comic books. She's been watching Westworld with Daddy, so maybe she'll want to talk about that.
Do you like that show?
Yeah, it's been really entertaining. There are 7 episodes in, and I've been watching it religiously. It's got Anthony Hopkins, who I love him. I think he's a fantastic actor, and I just almost feel like it just brings the show up a notch just because of his presence. But no, it's entertaining. It's fun. I'd recommend it.
There was a movie, I think, in 1974, 75 called Future World. And I never watched it, but they advertised it all the time, and that was a big movie people talked about. And then I think it was the next year, like 76, or maybe 2 years later, they had Westworld, and Yul Brynner was everywhere.
The Man in Black, wasn't he?
Yeah, what's your thing? That's from that movie, The Magnificent Seven. He, they were talking about, you know, he was all in black, and Yul Brynner loved that look, and he never took it off. They said when they did the movie, he always wore that outfit. And since then, a lot of the times, I remember he'd be on talk shows and stuff, and he'd come out in all in black without the cowboy hat. But Westworld, I guess that I never made sense to me why a cowboy. But now, and not seeing the movie was Yul Brynner's face taken off, and there's a robot, you know, cybernetics behind his face, dressed as the cowboy, and it said Yul Brynner is the gunfighter. But it was supposed to be the character from Magnificent Seven was on Westworld.
Oh, that's
ironic. I never
ironic.
Thought about it.
Ed Harris plays the Man in Black in this version.
Yeah.
It's I haven't seen Westworld, but from what you're explaining, it's completely different then, because the Man in Black isn't a robot in this one. But it's a really entertaining show. It's got some great actors in it too. It's on HBO, so it's not exactly super accessible for people unless you have HBO or HBO Go.
Well, both those movies, at the same time, I've never seen either one of them. But the way the premise seemed like it came out from the commercials is that Future World especially, they're talking about everything's perfect and all your dreams come true and stuff. But it can go wrong, very wrong. And then everything went wrong. And I think Westworld was the same thing, whereas it was a vacation place for families to go, like an amusement park, and all of a sudden the park went crazy and they were sending them out. And I don't know if the Yul Brynner character was bad. I was taking it he was, but maybe it's like Terminator where he was a robot trying to do good.
Yeah. It's funny. I had never heard of the 1970s film until the show came out, and I did a little research on it, and they were talking about the film, which was Michael Crichton, I think, wrote the screenplay for it.
He might have.
Yeah.
He might. He wrote a lot of those.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to see it just because I've been watching the show.
Yeah. Well, Michael Crichton's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. Speaking of good, let's jump into comic books.
All right. One thing about Dalgona. Now, if you listen to the show with episodes of Al and myself, one thing to set this up, used to be there was only certain mainstream publishers. There was Marvel, there was DC, there was Harvey Comics, there was Archie Comics, there was Gold Key Comics in Charlton. And that's all you ever saw on the newsstands was those companies. And in the magazine racks, they had, you know, Warren Magazine and some of those. But I would read about, in the late 70s, Eclipse Comics. And you could not find those things anywhere. And a lot of times, if you had a comic store in town, which we did, they didn't always have, you know, that stuff. And I'd read about it in trade publications. And they talk about Don McGregor, and I can't remember the artist, were doing Saber from Eclipse. What's Eclipse? Why can't we see this? This guy looks like Jimi Hendrix. And but you see these kind of books all the time. You start, Jim Starlin had early work before he went to Marvel. And I see advertisements for it. So, well, where can you get this stuff? And then eventually, you know, Pacific Comics came out, and then Eclipse was around, but all of a sudden they started getting to where people buy their books. The first comics came out. Fantagraphics was around, but I never saw the publications. My buddy Britt came from Dallas, Texas, and had all the comics journals and stuff. This is in 1981. And he had Amazing Heroes and a bunch of his stuff, which started coming by in Oklahoma later. But in 82, I was at a convention in Dallas, Texas, and Jan Stranaud and Gary Groth were there. And they were on a panel with John Byrne and Cary Gamble. And at one point, Jan Stranaud, who's a writer, has said that he doesn't have any drawing abilities. And the whole panel ended up turning into script writing for comics. And one thing he brought up was that good artwork can save a bad story. You know, art, and there's a big distinction between Al and myself and Dallas and Rook. We all appreciate art and we all like the art. And I even take it, if we don't like the art, we may not buy the book. But when Al and I grew up, art was the king. The story was there. I mean, I'd read stories I really liked, but it wasn't a deal breaker for me. Whereas I do think it is for you and Rook. I think you guys are more story driven than we were.
Yes, yes.
And but Jan Stranad was talking about, you know, bad good artwork can save a bad story, and he said it kind of remorsefully. And I'm thinking, well, of course, nobody buys it for the writer.
Which is ironic because there was kind of a, not the right word, but an artistic renaissance in the 90s where art definitely became very important again during that image era where the artists were once again the superstars and they were selling the books, basically.
Yeah, and there was some no of those, writing.
Yeah, there were, the story was minimal. You know, it was a bunch of basically one-liners.
You know, and I hear that and I do agree with that. But one thing, who was it? Todd McFarlane was talking about was, when he was doing Spider-Man for Marvel, when he was writing and drawing it, and he said, you know, the thing is, when he was, you know, they said he was going to write the book, he says, I know artwork. He says, but I didn't know story. And he said, they gave him carte blanche, but he kept asking for help for the story, and they weren't interested in helping him with the story. What they were doing was, you know, editing the artwork, telling him, you need to change this, change this, change this. And he kept saying, I know the artwork. I don't need help with that. Which, you know, that one, you need to be able to take some instruction.
You need criticism.
Yeah.
I think that's important for
artists
to grow.
To me, that was Stan Lee's greatest strength was he was a good editor.
Yes.
And he knew what to do to make the book sell. I mean, you know, when I listened to Roy Thomas about the Conan stuff, when Conan wasn't selling and when Stan Lee got more active and was telling about the covers. That was mostly Stan concentrating on the covers. And all of a sudden Conan went to barely selling to a huge book for DC, you know, for Marvel. But Todd McFarlane was saying that nobody would bother with the story, nobody corrected it, nobody really added it much. He says they were so concerned about the artwork. Well, again, that's what's selling, so that's what they're going to concentrate on. So it doesn't surprise me when these guys started Image that, you know, they weren't writers. You know, I mean, it sounds to me like those guys were all involved in the creative process and you came up with characters and even came up with story ideas.
Right.
But they weren't putting them together.
They weren't writers per se. Yeah. They couldn't craft a story. You know, they had some, like you said, they had story ideas. They had a big, maybe a plot they could throw out there, but they didn't know how to set it down and get from point A to point B. And
right.
I think that was one of the problems.
Well, that's something I hear now. Sometimes people complain about it's a writer's game. I do think the writers are driving the industry now. But I'm saying that the artists aren't taking a back seat. I've never seen at any point in my life so many fantastic artists.
Yeah, and you know, I used the word renaissance just a minute ago to explain that Image thing, but we're kind of in one right now in many respects because, yeah, you're seeing it's not just a writer's game. It is, there's areas in the industry where writers are pushing forward and doing amazing things. And then there's these amazing talents, these amazing artists that are out there, like David Aja. I was just reading the Hawkeye books we've talked about off-show.
Which are awesome.
Fantastic artist, fantastic storyteller, the way he paces things.
And even the fill-in artists were good as
well.
Yeah. No, that's what I mean. And a lot of the Image books that are out now, you got a very diverse, you know, group of stuff. I mean, it's from one spectrum to the other, any kind you want. And to me, it seems like a lot of freedom. The problem is I can't find a lot of these books that I like to read, you know, unless you special order them.
Which is so ironic. I was just going to say how you were talking about earlier, what was the Eclipse books, how back in the day it was very difficult to find those. And I take it for granted, but we're in a day and age where it's incredibly easy to find stuff for the most part. I mean, the books you're looking for, maybe you can't find them at your local bookstore, but you can somehow, by hook or by crook, go online and get them. By that respect, there are now so many companies out there, besides Fantagraphics, there's IDW and other companies that are reprinting old out-of-print books, or they're making collections of stuff that was heretofore unavailable. Books from the 50s, 60s, 70s, or even earlier. You know that back in the 80s, when you were looking for them, you never would have been able to find them. This day and age, so much stuff gets reprinted and collected that you can pretty much find anything you want, and I love it.
And that is super awesome. Especially
it's amazing for a comic book collector. It's a dream come true.
And those collections that they print up, to me, that's gold. And the one thing I have seen on the collections, they're not that expensive compared to the old days. you can get a really nice hardback, pristine, right production, and it is sweet as, you know.
Speaking of collected editions, I noticed a few episodes ago, you and Rook were talking about, what's that, Alex and Ada, one image book that you guys really like. You were talking about the collected editions. I think the series ended now, because I saw Yancey yesterday, Alex and Ada, the complete series, and it was a big, fat, like, $50 hardcover book, and apparently it's the entire run, so I don't know at what point it ended, but I think it's over now.
No, when we're talking about it, Rook was saying that it was going to be, like, what, 5-6 trades? And so he knew it was finishing, and the thing about Alex and Ada, when you showed me the digital copies, I said it interested me. So on Free Comic Day, I bought that first trade. I read it. I mean, I liked it, but I wasn't going to buy any others. So I read that one, even though I was kind of interested in what was going to happen. I wasn't interested enough to buy them.
Right.
And then it was funny. We did the show. We talked about it. Rook was kind of talking about what he didn't like. But at the same time, I could see it was piquing his interest. And so I said, here, you can just read it. And the next thing you know, Rook bought, what, 3 of them?
Yeah. And, he's good like that, man.
Yeah, and he's in it. He's in it for the long run, which was good because I got to read more of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I'll get to read all of it. But that was the thing. I'm still interested in reading the book. I just don't need to have copies of it.
Yeah, it's funny too. There's a book I wanted to get Don into now, and I have the digital version that I got from Humble Bundle. And it's an image book called Manhattan Projects, which I'm pretty sure I've talked about a long time ago. So my intention is to get Don into it, and then Don gets Rook into it. Rook buys all the successive issues so I can borrow them and read them.
Yeah, that's all. But anyway, we're talking about the setup there. Jan Strenod was talking about artwork and about, you know, how he was an artist, and he said he was planning a comic book with Dennis Fujitaki, who I had no idea who he was. And he had, in the panel he was describing, there was a picture of a spaceship being craned out of the water. And he said that he sent, you know, Dennis drew it from the script and sent it to him. He said, I found it amazing. It must have taken him days. Well, that whole panel was published in the Comics Journal, you know, basically word for word. Every time they did one of these panels, Gary Groff put up a little tape recorder, you know, a little Walkman type up in front. And it was transcribed, and everything said at that, you know, was there. And they printed this page in black and white. And I thought, my God, this is awesome. Why can't I get this? You know, I've never heard of this. Well, I kept waiting and waiting, you know, because, you know, in the comics world, if an issue, especially then, if an issue came out, and it was sold. Next thing you know, it was like $10, you know, and or $20, and you can never touch it. And I was always wanting to get it. Well, it never did come out. It finally came out in 1984, and it was either the end of '83 or beginning of '84. I bought this issue in Hawaii when my ship was going overseas, and I remember I picked it up, I read it, I thought it was great, but I reread it when Dallas started reading this, and it is so early 80s. Everything that's coming out in the late 70s and early 80s was a dystopian future, where we basically destroyed the world, which is something that is a grave concern, especially now. But now people just tend to ignore it. But in those days, people were talking about, you know, the ozone layer is going to deplenish. In different parts of the world, this book starts out, they pull the spaceship out of the water, and the Navy's out there getting it, and the main character in the book, besides Delgado, is a midshipman called Posey Ravencraft, and they pull him out, and they keep talking about his record. He had a bad record, but anyway, he came out, and when they pull the ship out, they say it's a canidin. Canadian? I keep seeing Canadian, but
I know. I always think it's Canadian, but it's so. Canida is the name of a planet full of dog like people, right?
Yeah.
Hence the canine, Canida.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. Every time I see it, I think Canada.
Yeah, I always read it as Canada, but that's just, you know. But anyway, when they end up in Hawaii, the guy who pulled out of the ship was the dog. It was Dalgoda. And what was funny was they had him on camera. And I can't remember exactly, but they said smile. He said he knew you were supposed to smile. So he smiled, but basically it came out like a sinister dog snarling at everybody. It was a scary, yeah. Terrifying. But anyway, when they go to Hawaii, where Posey Ravencraft lives, I bought the book in Hawaii. Hawaii is a paradise. You know, everywhere I go, the places I went, I'm sure I always hear about, poorer people, but even if you just live in a little hut, it's just paradise. It's some of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life. And when they drew this in the book, it's just like a slum, and it's raining all the time. It rains constantly. It was always raining. It was just dreary. And like I said, that was part of the environmental issues that people were concerned about in the late 70s and early 80s that is still a concern, but nobody seems to care anymore. But this book, when it came out, the color, the whole way they did it was just, I thought, so unique. I really enjoyed it. And there was a couple of guys in the ship that had the issues, and other guys read it, and every time they'd see an advertisement, it's a good comic. A lot of guys like Dalgoda. It's a series that's been completely forgotten now. I mean...
Yeah, I had never heard of it until Don brought it up. And, it's... The pacing, especially in that first issue, is really good. I like it. And it feels like it's setting something up big and epic.
Jane Stranod was a writer. I wasn't aware of him. He wrote for Marvel Comics for a little while, but he didn't stay there long. I think he was writing Spider-Man's, I don't know which one, but in Comics Journal, he wrote an article, says, "My Brilliant Career at Marvel Comics." And they even had examples of what he wrote and then what editorial change. And, he was writing, I guess there was a girl that somehow was going to school with Peter Parker, and he had his dialogue, and basically what they wrote was, "Oh, Peter, what do you have to treat me like a thrown away dish rag?" Stuff like that. And they were trying to make it the cheap soap opera teen stuff. But John Byrne and all these other guys just talking about, give this guy a good artist. He's a great writer. But I think he worked for Warren. But I know he wrote a lot of stories for Richard Corbin.
Oh, nice.
He wrote Jeremy Brood. He wrote Arabian Nights or Tales of the Arabian Nights with. He wrote a lot of stuff with Richard Corbin. If Al was here, he could tell you. Jan Stranod was, to me, a force to be reckoned with. When Dalgoda started, it seemed like him and Gary Groth were kind of a partners in printing comics. Because at one point, I guess in the end of the 80s, or 86, 85, 86, they started Mad Dog Graphics, which was supposed to be a comic company. They did publish some, but Jan Stranod was the one in charge, and I was reading about submissions for it. And what he was saying was, "We'll accept anything," but he wanted a complete series. If you're going to do it, he wanted four issues or six issues. And his intention was that after those issues came out, they were going to put in the trade. Back then, that wasn't thought of. There were some books like the Wolverine miniseries by Chris Claremont and Frank Miller was collected. There was a few things like that, but it was rare. But Jan Stranod was already looking at, the way I take it, Japanese manga is taken. It's serialized in magazines and then put out in trades if they do really well. And that's what he was wanting to do. Of course, Mad Dog Graphics. And he said you could take anything, superhero, monsters, westerns, any genre he was looking for. Since then, it seemed like he's just kind of left comics, except once in a while when he does something with somebody. But anyway, Dalgoda went on for 8 issues, and then that ended. But that's when Mad Dog Graphics came out, and they put out a 4-issue series called Flesh and Bones, which completed, so it's basically 12 issues, completed the whole Dalgoda saga.
That's right. It's, I had the luxury of reading all 12 in a row, as basically one complete story. And from what you're saying, I mean, it sounds like Jan Strnad kind of had that intention. He wanted you to sit down and read like a collected edition. So I wasn't waiting month to month or bi-monthly or however it was coming out to actually read the books. But so I got to do that. I read all 12 kind of in a row. And he is a good writer. I'll give you that. I'm not too familiar with the rest of his work and what else he's done. But yeah, I liked it. It does, to me, it seems to kind of meander a little bit after the first couple of issues, and I didn't know if that was intentional or not, because it just seemed like maybe he didn't know what he was planning on doing after the fourth or fifth issue, and it just kind of started to get into strange territory. But it did bring itself back full circle by the end, and I mean, it is a complete tale, and it has a pretty solid ending. So, I mean, you get satisfaction when you finish it.
That's something I think Al and I were talking about in another podcast, was when you binge read something, like, remember Akira from Epic Comics, the Japanese series?
Yeah.
Now that was like 45, you know, big, thick.
Yeah, that was huge. Yeah. That was a long, long story.
Now that came out monthly, and then after a while, well, it continued to come out monthly. And after a while, it started coming like bi-monthly. It slowed down. I guess the creator hadn't finished it yet. But, you know, every month I picked that up. And there was a couple of points where things changed so much, and I thought, where is this character from? It just seemed like all of a sudden I missed a few issues. I'd go back and look, now I've got them all. So at one point, before the series is finished, I had some time off, and I just binge read. Much different. You know, when you're reading in succession, issue after issue, you know, you realize where these characters were, where they were introduced, where they came from, but, you know, after a month, you know, it was kind of weird. It was fast-moving and slow-moving all at the same time, and it was kind of hard month-to-month to piece it all together. Reading Del Goda, like I said, it was coming out, I think, it wasn't a monthly comic book. It came out bi-monthly, four times a year or something like that. And so when I picked these things up, it didn't quite seem meandering to me, because it kind of let you back into that world again.
Yeah, and I can see that, and that's why I feel like it's good for a monthly format. That's where it probably had its strength.
I do know it changed at one point, because Del Goda in the book, he's a milquetoast character. He's not a heroic type.
Which is hilarious, and I didn't expect that at all. Yeah. The first issue almost sets him up, because you're looking at it from an outside perspective. It sets him up almost like he's kind of a hero, like he's a strong guy.
Yeah.
And by the second issue, you're like, oh, this guy's kind of a wuss. Like, what's going on here? He's the lead character. You know, you expected this to be a strong adventure book, and for him to be, you know, kind of that genre hero, and they completely flip that on its head.
Now, the character, the human character, Posey Ravencraft, he's a midshipman. Now, the terminology you're using isn't quite right, Navy. And when I was in the Navy, a midshipman was a student. You know, a student that was training to become an officer. But they wore the same outfits the enlisted men did. They had the Dixie cup, white cap, you know. But in this one, Posey Ravencraft was a naval officer. And they were already making a contact with that canine planet.
Canada?
Yeah, Canida, whatever they call it. But he had a bad record. And I guess he left and he came back as a midshipman, which actually, it seems to me, it's more of a enlisted man, because a midshipman is usually young guys that had never been out of school. But he's wearing the regular sailor suit. But they bring him in to work with it. Well, like I said, he's got a squalid little one-room studio apartment, which that's being kind to even say that.
Yeah, it's a dump.
But, yeah, it's not even a closet. But Posey Ravencraft, his wife was caught in bed with a canine. And so that's why they were thinking, you know, they couldn't quite trust him. And he was with Del Goda. And when you're reading this, it seems to me like he's Del Goda's friend, but sometimes I kept taking it like, you know, maybe he's just using Del Goda for his own means and he's going to screw him. There's some of that going on in the book.
Yeah, it was always fun to have that kind of air of mystery. Like, they seemed like the two main characters, the heroes. But, yeah, you never knew Posey's intentions, if they were really completely pure. And, at least in the first few issues, you don't.
Yeah, and you got Secret Service showing up, and that was funny. The Secret Service were there, and they're guys in suits with sunglasses. And they'd be in a diner, and they kept, while they're doing it, okay, don't draw attention. You know, look away, and they'd be talking to people. And they would get up, says, walk smoothly and smartly with a purpose. Like, no, don't let anybody notice you. And they'd walk out, and everybody, oh, Secret Service. You can tell, you know?
Everybody knew.
That was funny. But you got a lot of... It's kind of shown, which I'd never seen before reading this in comic books, was if you have a visitor from another planet, it's not going to be simple like how Superman came and the Kents took him in and raised him as theirs. It's like you start seeing all the different politics going on in the background and all the red tape and all the different factions coming in and their own self-interest. And I don't know, I did enjoy that.
Yeah, it was always nice having that because it felt like a bigger world than what they were showing, too.
Yeah.
It felt like there was more going on behind the scenes, even if you didn't see it happening. So, yeah, it was fun. So, what do you think about the art?
Now, that's what I was going to be talking about. I love Dennis Fujitaki. I look at it now, and I still love it. I think he's terrific. I like the technical aspects, and I like the tightness. And surprisingly, looking at it now, you wouldn't think, but at the time, it was a heavy Mobius influence on it.
That's so funny because that's exactly what I thought, though. When I saw it, I'm like, and this is being disrespectful to the guy, and I apologize, but it reminded me of a poor man's Mobius.
Yeah, well, I don't think you would take it that way. This is how Dennis Fujitaki draws, but he was really stretching out. I'm guessing he must have done comics work before. He worked... I don't think it ever stopped, but he worked for a television station in Hawaii. And, you know, he was an artist there. And he continued with Delgota. He was still working at that was his main job. And I'd even go so far to say that that's saying something because Britt grew up in Hawaii. And he was watching that TV show Kikaida. It was a Japanese live-action TV show. Kind of like Power Rangers. You know, the guy had a motorcycle. It'd be a regular guy that all of a sudden would do some pose and turn into this robot. And he was always a robot. But, you know, his human guys would go away. And the strip went on, or the show went on forever. It was a comic strip by Shitiro Ishimori, which was a terrific 1960s comic strip. It's some of my favorites. But that was Britt's, you know, hero next to all the Jack Kirby stuff. Well, on the internet, they had a station called Japan Radio, which is where I discovered a lot of the Japanese bands I listened to. And at one point, every once in a while, they'd have a commercial, and the guy would refer to the audience as a certain name. I can't remember, it was like a nickname. And he says, if you know this name, then you know, I know you've already bought the season sets of Kikaida. So, of course, I told Britt, because every time I went to Hawaii, I'd find Kikaida stuff and send it to him. And he was always like, man, that's my childhood. Because you couldn't find it in the United States, every time, or in the mainland. Every time he talked to me about Kikaida, I had no idea what he's talking about, and he'd draw it. And, but, you know, when I told Britt about it, he says, they have what? This is before I'd met you. It was a while back.
Man, that was a long time ago.
So I listened to the website information, I'd write it down and send it to him. And then Britt bought, I don't know, 3 or 4 of those volumes, you know, those season sets. And he was asking us, are you guys have any intentions of selling these out here in the mainland? They were only sold in Hawaii. And their answer to him was, no, we're not, because of copyright issues. They didn't want people to get in the mainland and start pirating everything. And he says, that sounds to me like, you know, the record industry, where they're trying to control everything so much, and it just kind of died out. But I'm guessing it was the Japanese owners that didn't want to do it. But the television station was the one that put those together, and he said the graphics were second to none. It wasn't just like they just threw a bunch of old episodes on and threw them out. They had a lot of background files, a lot of illustrations, a lot of, you know, DVDs just used to be packed full of stuff. But the television station really promoted that when Britt watched it. And they didn't just show the shows. I guess they added stuff onto it. And you know, key characters and character guides and stuff like that, background. So I don't know. I'm guessing Dennis Fujitaki, I don't know if he worked on those, but he was doing the same type of work for the station in Hawaii.
And that was his main job, so he was a busy guy. Yeah. And on top of that, he was doing a bi-monthly comic book, which is crazy. And yeah, the art, you know, I don't mean to degrade it. It's good. It's solid work, and it's, you know, it takes time. It's not like he just scribbled this out really quickly. This takes a while to do. So, man, he was a busy guy.
Yeah, he was. I do like the artwork. I mean, I love Dennis Fujitaki, and he just got better and better. Looking at it now, though, he looks like a technical artist, and his people are... I want to say his people look a little stiff, but not stiff like John Byrne's early work stiff. But, and I can see where he's got a lot of character acting in it, and, you know.
Yeah, they're expressive to an extent. I feel like they're expressive, but he only has a couple different kinds of expressions that he conveys.
Yeah, that was, you know, like, and that was it. It's, everybody almost seems like they have the same hairstyle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Everything seems to be cut from the same cloth, which I honestly didn't have any problem with. That's just something that you see on this. But when I see it, I love it. The colors is what throws me.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the colors, but it's almost typical 80s style coloring.
Yeah, well,
I guess.
I like the color, don't get me wrong. And at the time, this is something, because this book wasn't on newsprint. It was on a...
That's right, it's thicker paper.
Yeah, and it's a slick paper, and it's processed color. It's not just the hand-separated screen color. But the colors are kind of... Which they did this on purpose. The problem was superhero comics on newsprint. They were really bright, you know, primary garish colors. But the newsprints soaked the colors in and kind of dulled them down. And they started printing those things on slick paper like Marvel's great... What was that... The Origins of Marvel Comics was the first trade that they put out, Marvel put out. It was a thick, almost phone book, and it had the origin of the Fantastic Four and the later Fantastic Four story. It had all the origins of, I'm guessing Doctor Strange. I've got it. It's got a, it had the Galactus trilogy. It had, Origins of Marvel Comics had the first story of the Fantastic Four, and I think it published, maybe it didn't. It had a later issue of Fantastic Four, and then it had, I think it had Captain America, but it had all those. It had an origin story and then a later story.
And those were on prestige paper?
Yeah, but this came out in 74.
Oh, okay.
And, he put out two. Marvel put out How to Draw Marvel Comics by Stan Lee and John Buscema.
And then, I had that.
Yeah, well, it was the same format, but, Origins of Marvel Comics, it was thick, and it was on that bright paper, which I didn't quite mind, but a lot of people talk about just how garish, because, you know, that color just, you know, jumped out at you.
It really does. You notice a difference if it's on that paper as opposed to newsstand paper.
Now, that's one thing, again, that panel Jan Stranod was on, they were talking about comic coloring, because at this time, Marvel was doing that series of graphic novels, which I loved, but it was on that slick paper, and they were still coloring it, you know, with the hand separation film. Same thing. And they were complaining about how garish it was. So this one, I think they kind of muted, you know, they tried to make it a little faded, which is fine, but it's a lot of 80s bubblegum kind of colors.
Yeah, it really is. The story's fun. I noticed, like I said before, it meanders, so it takes a bunch of strange right turns. And the last couple of issues were fun because they're just basically science fiction adventure. The last couple are really fun because they're on Dalgoda's homeworld. And so you're getting something that it becomes a completely different animal than it was the first couple issues, which is kind of neat. It turns into something completely different.
One thing that happened on that was, it was, I guess, midway through the series, they were talking about you're going to see a change. Dalgoda's going to be more of a hero and more of a stronger character. But the reason why they did that was Dennis Fujitaki drew a picture of Dalgoda, I think like in a fighter pilot type outfit. You know, it's his own design, but he was standing there looking heroic. And I think he just drew it for fun and sent it to Jan Stranod. Jan Stranod loved it.
And it's funny how Yeah. One image kind of would completely change the course of the series.
Yeah, and that's what it changed, because all of a sudden, just to bring it up, the planet Earth, after a while, they gave Dalgoda
his own ship.
Yeah,
right. And
there was a couple of ships. Well, there was three ships, I think. But there was the main ship. And there was a second ship called the Lady, which was smaller. I think there was a third ship, but I can't remember what it was.
I think so, too.
But anyway, I guess there was an invasion force that was going to destroy Canada, and there were bugs. And then Dalgoda, I don't think, was supposed to be the liaison to Earth, but he got tricked into it. It's later on you find out. But he was in love.
Yeah, it's a whole kind of convoluted thing there that they show through flashbacks, and you learn the story. So that was a little strange. But, I like how it all came together in the end, but it was a little confusing reading it.
Well, they were supposed, to send another guy, another dog to Earth. What was the heroic type? Well, Dalgoda had the hots for, He was pining for that guy's girlfriend, who was extremely beautiful. And at the same time, in that group of, space cadets or whatever they were, there was another female that was pining for Dalgoda. And somehow, the heroic dog's girlfriend, she was the one that caused the switch. And
yeah,
got Dalgoda.
She tricked Dalgoda, basically. That's right, because she wanted her boyfriend to stay, I think.
Right, and Dalgoda's a typical, he's like my dog. He's wistful, he's only thinking of his next meal and relaxing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's just, you know, which is funny. The other funny thing is, whenever anything was happening, and they were being chased or, you know, attacked, Dalgoda would, he'd whimper. He acted like a dog, whereas the other guy was more like a Rottweiler or something. He would go after you. But anyway, it's the ship, the series changed. There were some other characters that showed up. There was a guy named Victor Needham, who was the one that I think kind of destroyed Posey Ravencraft's career. I forgot about that.
Yeah, Victor was allegedly, he was a pilot, and he was drunk at one point while flying. And he crashed his ship and caused a lot of damage. That was a whole weird storyline that played out very strangely.
And it destroyed a lot of people's careers, including Posey's.
Yeah.
And Posey, a lot of things happened to him. And as you find out in the series, Victor wasn't drunk.
Yeah, I think that was some of Jan Sternad's strong character work, is taking this Victor Needham character.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the series, he's this despicable person, and you start to like him slowly over the course of the series, where he turns into a very likable character. Almost a heroic character near the end.
And he kind of takes Posey's place, because Dalgoda and Victor are...
become friends.
Yeah, they're... they're lost. They end up in that Polynesian island.
That's right. They get stranded, the two of them together. And that's when you start to get a little more sympathetic for
Yeah, and then you find out why Victor, why that was happening. Yeah, that was probably my favorite part. And there's also a female mechanic called Gunner. She's bald, and she has the geometric eye makeup over one eye.
And she wants to bang Dalgoda really bad.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, if they would have wrote that comic now, she would have been a lesbian the way they write her. But at the time, you know, she was a really strong character.
Yeah, another strong character in the series. There's a lot of them with good personalities, distinct personalities.
Right, and that's something when I talk about the visual look. This is when MTV was going strong, and Adam and the Ants and Duran Duran was out. Duran Duran's video always had these geometric shapes, and bands like Missing Person and Adam and the Ants always had that war paint makeup on and stuff. So you'd have characters like Gunner with this blue geometric thing over one eye. It was just greatness. Anyway, as they're going back to Canada on these ships, at one point Dalgoda just turns into Captain Bligh, and Victor Needham is following around with a notepad and taking notes, and Dalgoda's like, this place is filthy, have the crew come in here, wipe everything down with disinfectant immediately. Yes sir. Well, the rest of the crew is just about to Shanghai or mutiny. They're getting really upset, and then he takes Gunner and has her move her whole workshop, you know, she's an engineer, to the Lady. And she's so upset because she's got this wide space, and the Lady's this little tiny, you know, closet they're going to move her into. And so the Lady's not equipped. Why do I have to go to the Lady? But he's got everybody in the crew moving to other parts. Nobody knows what's happened. Everybody's grinding their teeth. Everybody's wanting to, you know, mutiny. And then finally, at the very end, they find out what happened was that he couldn't trust the rest of the crew because they were wanting to do something else. So he put the ones he could trust on the lady, and they were just going to take the lady to Canada. And I thought, okay, that was it. I really enjoyed when they were showing the flashbacks of Canada and the whole crew, the cadets or whatever, and the whole plan on what they're going to do, you know, coming to Earth.
Oh, yeah.
And then what happened? It was hyperdrive. There was another thing. It was hyperdrive that could make that jump. But if you didn't make the jump, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's about when it started to turn into a completely different series.
Yeah, at the beginning.
Completely shifted.
I guess Earth and Canida, I can't ever say it right, they were making contacts through radio waves. But it was going to take 100 years to get to them, each other. And I think they sent out a pilot to do something like that. And I think finally the Canidan finally made it to Earth. But it wasn't well received, you know, and I think he was killed. And all of a sudden that's when hyperdrive came out and they could make the jump in a short period of time. And it just threw everything out. And then I think they outlawed it. And that's why they had to stop the whole thing. And there was no connection between either planet. And it was all a distant memory until Dalgoda showed up. Anyway, we've meandered quite a while. And why don't we take a music break?
All right, let's do it.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And we're back. That was, that's a band called Polyphia. The song's called Champagne. This is a group that, that my buddy Brent got me into. Brent's a fellow guitarist. And man, I love this band because they are absolute virtuosos at their, you know, their instruments, but they're also amazing at songwriting. And I mean, the way that song is structured is fantastic, and I love it. And Emily's throwing her toys everywhere. All right, so we're still talking about Delgoda, man. I think this is going to be an all Delgoda episode, which is pretty fun that, you know, we put it off for so long talking about this, and I'm glad it's still fresh enough in our minds that we can talk. But it deserves an entire episode just because we waited so long to do this, you know?
As it should be.
Yeah. So,
as it should be.
So, yeah, I was talking about kind of the meandering aspect of the story and how it keeps on shifting and how it kind of makes sense if you read it on a bi-monthly basis, you know, because each issue is semi-self-contained. So especially the first few issues, you know, they could have almost been just one-shots, which I kind of liked about that aspect.
Yeah.
So as it kind of changes, there's a whole sequence of issues that take place kind of just aboard a spaceship. And there's a bunch of shenanigans that ensue there. And that was kind of fun. You get introduced into some new characters. And Jan Sternad's character work stays very strong. Some of these characters become very sympathetic. There's another, I think she's a pilot that's in here. And she's very important in the last few issues.
I forgot about her.
And I can't remember her name, yeah. But she becomes just as important as any of the main characters. And it's great that that late into the story, they introduce somebody that integral to the plot. And yeah, like I said, those last few issues I really liked because it had a satisfying ending and it was a completely different feel than the first few issues.
Yeah, they're on the second issue. They basically get the ship and that's when they introduce the crew.
Yeah.
And they're bringing Victor and Needham in, which I didn't remember. They had a problem, but for some reason they needed him. And that's when he introduced Gunner. And what was neat on the ship was they had a botanical garden on it. Which would make sense
if you're doing deep space flights.
Sorry, Don's reaching down to pick up these toys. So if you hear random noises and our voices cutting out, that's why. That's the beauty of doing this live like this.
But every episode, or every issue, something attacked Delgoda. You know, on this,
and that's kind of what I meant by one shots. Like the first few couple of issues were kind of, yeah, like, oh, in this issue he gets attacked by this kind of villain. In this issue, it's almost like the villain of the week.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. Well,
and that only lasts for the first couple of issues or so, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah, the first issue is him looking heroic, you know, in a spacesuit with these odd spacecraft behind him. In the second issue,
he gets his ass beat by a bunch of plants.
Yeah, it's basically he's like a sliding door with a graphic lock on it. And there's these vines, you know, pulling it back in.
And it's funny, each successive issue, you're looking like, then look at issue 3, then issue 4, and on the cover, he's like scared and being, you know, he's just in the middle of something crazy in every cover. And I'm sure we'll post the covers, but if we don't, just go Google Delgoda and look at the covers. There's only 12 issues total, so it's just hilarious.
Yeah, I think this was put into a trade years and years and years ago. I think it was an early trade. But this would be nice if they'd put it out and kind of remastered the colors. I mean, when I say they don't over-render the colors. But
kind of like they did with The Killing Joke a few years back. Remember that?
Yeah, well, they do that with a lot.
Yeah, Rook and I had an episode where we compared the two and talked about the differences between Brian Bolland's Killing Joke book and the original so-called gaudy colors of the late 80s issue, and then the updated colors. And I think we decided that the gaudy colors we preferred, and one of the major reasons, I'm sure, is because we grew up with that and it looked good to us.
Well, yeah, that's something. The Inkle, my favorite work, is by Mobius, and it had the coloring I thought was fantastic for, you know, the time. Well, then they put out a monthly comic book by the I can't remember the name of that artist. It wasn't...
Was it the Meta Barons?
It was the same time as Meta Barons. It was just called The Inkle, but they put out a trade called Before The Inkle.
Which you talked about in a number of episodes.
Yeah, and we just talked about it recently. But the colors were fantastic. But they were real metallic looking, grayish. You know, there was bright colors in it, but you know, the reds and everything was kind of darkened a bit, like crimson and stuff. But it was, I thought, staggering, and it gave it an airbrushed 3D look to it up to a point. It had depth. And it had a lot of rendering in the color, which they tend to do now. Well, in the back of the comic, they had all the stuff about, I guess this came out in Europe way before we ever got it. And they were showing it, that they were using what they call the cotton candy colors of European comics that we knew. Mm-hmm. Like the Inkle was colored in. Mm-hmm. And I guess there was, they put those out, and I looked at it. I did like it, but I didn't mind the new coloring. And I think they put the Inkle out, the original Mobius work, in those type of colors as well, which I prefer what they did. Well, now when Humanoids put out the trade, they put it close to the original colors.
Okay.
Not quite the cotton candy colors they're talking about, but, you know, they were muted and they were nice. This one, I do like how they did the color palettes. Like, sometimes there's a lot of purples and gold, and sometimes there's oranges and gold. Sometimes it's greens and purples or violets.
Well, and I would prefer, generally, to see the original colors going with the original artwork, because that's how it was intended to be seen. You know, and so for the most part, I would like the old Inkle colors, because that's how I viewed the original Inkle comic, is by the original colors, the cotton candy colors, yeah, that it was originally released in. One exception to that rule that I was kind of shocked that I did like was a trade paperback that I bought a couple of years back, and it was a collection of old Thor backup stories by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. And it was called Tales of Asgard, and it was all the old Tales of Asgard stories that used to be in the back of Journey into Mystery, I believe. Anyway, they were completely collected into one trade paperback, completely recolored with all digital coloring and gradients and all the new style of color. And surprisingly, I thought it looked amazing. I was shocked at how good Kirby's work looked with new techniques and digital renderings. So that was something I was shocked that I liked.
I agree with you. One thing, Dark Horse did the Conan, the Barry Smith Conan work. They published all the old Marvel. They did the John Buscema, the Gil Kane, all this stuff. But my complaint about the Barry Smith, a lot of people complained about it, was they muddied the line work up. Like, you know, a lot of those, he's out in the snow, and they tried to, through Photoshop, I'm guessing, they put snow over them.
Make it more realistic, maybe. They thought they would, yeah.
Yeah, destroyed the line work. There was one artist on Facebook that had posted examples of what he resubmitted to Dark Horse to redo, and he followed the colors that they put in. But his thing was the line work, which, again, that's what you don't want to lose, is the line work. And the Tales of Asgard, they put the blank plate on top, the line work on top of the colors, which
really
is how you should.
And that makes sense, because it makes his art stand out more, so you're not losing that. On a couple episodes ago, our Halloween episode, I think we were talking about some horror books. God, who was it? Bernie Wrightson. We were talking about the colored version of some of his black and white books, and we were talking about how the colors were muddy, and it did kind of overpower some of his line work and his inking.
Well, no, in those cases, what happened there was that was 1980s technology. The computers weren't coloring stuff then. And what they were doing was a lot of Bernie Wrightson stuff had gray tones on it. You know, and that's why they colored it with the gray tones, and that's what gave it the muddiness. They still put what they could of the black plate on top. I want to say that I loved it. I look at the black and white work now, which I had never seen before, and yeah, it's superior. But I still have a soft spot in my heart for those colorized.
That's funny that I would use the word superior when talking about the black and white ones too.
Yeah.
And my first exposure was also the color ones, like you. I had the Tales of Bernie Wrightson or whatever those collected books were. I had them, and the first time I saw those stories, they were in color. But later, when I discovered them in black and white, I totally preferred them, and I would choose them every time.
Well, you know, saying that, if I would have seen the old, you know, creepy, you know, Bernie Wrightson work, and then I would have saw those, you know, reprinted in color, I would have been the biggest jerk. Oh, this sucks. It's far superior. You know?
You would have been the snotty guy.
But instead, it was, you know,
the opposite.
And the colors they used went with it. It was neat. And it gave it a different look to it. But yeah, it's, Neil Adams did that Muhammad Ali versus Superman, and they reprinted that. I've got the reprint, and same thing. They did the colors, and I thought it was pretty awesome because, like, especially on the blue in Superman's uniform, they kind of rendered the muscles a little bit just with highlights. And Muhammad Ali, his face, you know, he's a black man, but the browns, they have different type skin tones showing highlights, nice. And it gives it a depth. Well, and then they put Neil Adams lines on top of it, so it's not much. That's how you should do it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I had never heard of that. I didn't know that that's how they did it.
And they like I said, they still follow the original color guys on it. But Dalgoda, well, I wish they'd put these things out and keep the same color scheme, but kind of.
Well, it's funny. I feel in Dalgoda, the artist, Dennis Fujitaki's art kind of lends itself to this gaudy, big, colorful scheme, though. Like, I couldn't imagine it being any more detailed as far as the colors. And it's just because a lot of it's simple line work. And when I say that, the characters have very clear, clean lines to them. The backgrounds and some of the stuff is quite detailed, actually. But the characters themselves, I compared it to Mobius earlier. I couldn't imagine Dalgoda being highly detailed when it came to the coloring. I like it just the way it is. It's a product of its time. I mean, you grew up with these books. You come from a different era than I do. But when I see it, it screams 80s to me. You know? I mean, the package, the presentation, not just the story itself, you know, like you were saying earlier, but the colors, the art itself, the panel layouts, everything just screams 1980s to me. And that's not a bad thing.
It was a great time. I want to say that the 80s, I've brought this up before. When I was in college, and one of the professors I had was literature. And it was two professors that taught that class. It was a massive class, and they were really interesting, but very dour. They always spoke like this all the time. And they were talking about, what do you call it?
I'm sorry, I'm taking pictures of you because you're holding Emily, and I'm throwing the whole show off, man. I'm sorry.
But they were talking about they read something really kind of hopeless, and the professor was just saying, "Well, anyone's thoughts? Just remember, 1984 is only 2 years away."
And, so that was kind of the feeling of the times.
Well, people had this. And that's when, I think it was HBO had that big special on Nostradamus, and they were talking about all the plans and all the things, and cannibalism and famine and death, and, you know, and I'm watching, I says, wait a minute, this is, none of that's leading, looks like it's leading up to that. And my friend's wife's like, yeah, but that's what he says, is that nobody's going to know what else is just going to happen. And so everybody's kind of like, and then, you know, 1984, New Year's came, and as soon as it hit 1984, nothing but George Orwell jokes.
Yeah, I bet.
And National Lampoon's first cover for 1984, it was a woman, you're looking through a keyhole, and you see a young teenage woman or 20-year-old woman getting in the bathtub naked. And it says, it's 1984. Little brother is watching.
Yeah, and that's a pretty famous cover, too. I remember that, you know, just for what it is.
And that's, like I said, it wasn't the George Orwell or you know, Nostradamus 84. It was fashion bands, big hair, bright colors, MTV. It was a big party. It was so much fun.
Like you said, Duran Duran, the romantics.
Yeah.
The romantic movement and music.
Blondie, all that stuff that was going on.
I was 4 years old. Ellie was zero. She was born in 84.
I saw the world in 84, and I met my wife in 84.
Isn't that right, Emily? Isn't that right?
And you'll get to do things like that, too.
That's right.
But no, it's, when I look at these, like I said, different eyes, but I wish Dalgoda was a book that would come out again. And when I say this, I've always told a story that I subscribed to it at my store. And I had already had one issue, and I didn't buy it. I'd gotten into a fight with the owner, who was a friend of mine, and I bought the issue somewhere else, and it looked like I just shot him through the heart. I should have bought that issue as well. But he said, well, look, man, I ordered these for you. You need to tell me if you're going to buy it somewhere else so I don't have it. And I think, well, you'll sell it. He never did. And I moved here to Florida and came back to see him a couple of times, and that was still on the shelf for years.
He's like, hey, you're back. You finally going to buy this thing?
I should have bought it, but I mean, it never sold. It sat there by itself. And when I say that, there was a lot of guys that loved that on the ship, and it was a popular book. A lot of, you know, me and all my friends read it. I read it religiously. To me, when the rare times I see an issue in the dollar box, I buy it. I bought one of Yancey last time we all went.
Yeah, well, it's just, and it's funny too, because I obviously wasn't reading comic books at the time, but even when I started reading comics, 1989, I was 9 years old. You know, I hadn't heard a word of Delgoda throughout the years, throughout as long as I've been reading books. I've never heard of Delgoda until you brought it up.
Well, Delgoda, like I said, they finished it after 12 issues. Dennis Fujitaki did, I think it was Eclipse put out a, Eclipse put out a book, like a big graphic novel. And I'm thinking there was another artist in it, Kevin Nolan or somebody. And but Dennis Fujitaki did a story about a dragon, which I loved. And then after that, when Mad Dog Graphics was coming out, they put out a, I think Dennis Fujitaki did a series called Retief, which is there's a writer called Keith Lamar, which wrote about the guy was an ambassador, a diplomat, but he was a two-fisted diplomat. Like, he used his wits, he was a problem solver, but he wasn't just completely full-tilt diplomat where he only used words and papers. There were times where he just, kind of like a John Wayne character, where he just punched the guy right in the face and cut through the red tape. It was a whole long series of books. Matt Howarth, the cartoonist I love, he was a huge fan of those books, and he created a comic strip based around a female, based off that character. But Dennis Fujitaki did 5 issues of Retief. He wrote and drew it, but Jan Strnad got, I think he wrote script. He was a script writer for that. So I'm guessing they kind of did it kind of Marvel style, where the artist wrote and drew it, and then he went in and filled in the... Those were... To me, that was Dennis Fujitaki at the height of his powers. It was a black and white series, and then after that...
I'd like to see his work in black and white.
I'll bring those in next time. As a matter of fact, they had... at Wilson's, for a long time, they had a trade of it. And every time you went to Wilson's, I tried to make you buy it. And, of course, you're like, But I'm like, I almost bought it I don't know how many times. And then I thought, look, you got the comic books, don't buy that. Let somebody else get it, you know. And somebody did. But there was about maybe 5-6 months, and you went there 2 or 3 times. And every time I was trying to strong arm you into buying that, you know, it was kind of embarrassing. But but I look back at those with, I mean, when I bought each issue, it was like, oh man, it was everything comics should be. And now I look Dennis Fujitaki up to see what I missed, and I don't ever see any of the comics work he's done. I'm guessing he just concentrated more on the illustration graphics work he was doing, which must be fantastic. But
I'm sure it is. Okay. Well, look, I think we're getting to the end of the episode. Do you have any last thoughts to close out our Delgoda talk?
Well, like I said, we were haphazard when we did this. We weren't really. You know, we didn't walk you through it. We told you some things about it.
It's also been a little while since we've read it.
Yeah. And, like I said, these are books I read all the time in the 80s and early 90s. I used to pull them out of the box and read them again. Once I started raising a daughter, I haven't pulled them out since, I don't know, 10, 12 years. I've always talked to Dallas about it, tried to get Dallas to read them. When Dallas did, I thought, well, I need to reread these too. I loved them just as much reading them last summer as I have way back in the 80s and 90s. It's to me just, it's one of the greatest strips ever done. It's the same creative team all the way through, which to me is, that's the selling point to me. And both of these guys are great. I understand some of it's dated now. And I don't know. I can't say enough about it. The whole design of the series is fantastic. If they did reprint it like I always wish they would, I don't know how well it would sell. But nevertheless, it's out there. You can find the issues. I imagine there's a couple of trades of this. I think they did trade it. But I found some issues in the dollar box. To me, that's just a treasure. I can't say enough about it.
Nice. I definitely enjoyed it, and I'm glad I got to read them. They're, like I said, they're definitely of their time, but... If you grew up reading this, or if you listening out there enjoy the books that Don talks about, then you'll love this.
And
it
if
really
you'd like to read stories from when the world is really, really, really awesome, then read Dalgona.
All right, well, I want to throw just a couple quick plugs for us. First off, guys, we're on iTunes, so if you're listening to us on iTunes, please, we would love some reviews or some stars. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, give a rating. All you have to do is just rate it with the stars.
It'll take you 5 seconds, so we would definitely appreciate that. That helps us get a little bit of exposure, so more people will be able to find us on iTunes.
And if you want to write a review, that's even better.
Yes.
And but you don't have to.
I also, my comic strip, Daddy Up, which you can find on Facebook, and you can also find on DaddyMindTricks.com, which is a website for fathers. Anybody can read it, though. Anyway, my comic strip, Daddy Up, the Thanksgiving strip should be out by the time this episode is released, so check that out. Next up, I'll have a Christmas strip.
And, right, no, if you'd, you said you'd send me an icon. If you send me an icon, we could put it on the sidebar.
Yeah, I definitely will.
It'd be easier to find.
Speaking of our site, you can find a bunch of dorks.com. We're putting up a new feature, too, a new segment on there, which is going to be recommended reading. Each of us, Don, Al, Rook, and myself, are each choosing 10 books which we would recommend to the casual reader for further reading. So go on there and check them out, and they all have links to their appropriate Amazon pages, so you'll be able to buy the book right there from our website. So check that out. That's going to be fun.
And also tell them about this is way in the future, but Dallas and I were talking about it. Heroes World. Heroes Con.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, this is not happening until 2018, but in 2018, which is about a year, 2 years from now, the group's going to be getting together. We're going to be taking a road trip out to Heroes Con. The reason we're not doing it next year in 2017 is my daughter's just going to still be a little too young, and I really don't want to leave her for an extended period of time. But summer 2018, we're all going out to Heroes Con. We're going to stay out in North Carolina for a few days and just hang out, just have a couple drinks, go out to dinner, and we're going to record live from the event, from the convention. Yeah.
Okay.
Don's finding this out for the first time right now. But we are going to have an absolute blast. We're going to have a lot to talk about, a lot of good fun experiences. And if any of you guys are in that area near North Carolina, or if you want to take a trip out, we would love to hang out, maybe even bunk up with you guys, just catch up, go to dinner, maybe even go to the convention together. So contact us through our Facebook page or the website. And, you know, we can start making plans now. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, and if you ever wanted, I've heard nothing but great things about Heroes Con. Al's gone to it. Way back when I first got to know you, you were telling me about a podcast called Pyrrhonic Victories.
Pyrrhic, right?
Pyrrhic. And they had the Hernandez Brothers and Peter Bagg on it. Al was there in the audience.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right.
And I've heard nothing but great things. My friend Scott Connor goes to it almost every year. So if you ever want to go to Heroes Con, which I'm told they concentrate on the creators, it's not so much other things. But if you ever want to go, you'll know somebody there.
Exactly. You know? We can meet up, like I said, hang out. So, yeah, that's really going to do it for this episode. We just kind of wanted to throw those things out. So everyone, thank you so much for listening to us. The only regret that I have for this episode is I wrote an awesome little Pullapalooza segment, and we forgot to put Pullapalooza in the episode.
we didn't have a stack to
yeah,
do Pullapalooza. I love that, by the way. That was awesome.
So, all right, guys, that's going to be it for this episode. So you can find another one in about a week or so. And until then, take care of yourselves and
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas' webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!